So tonight we do begin a new journey through the book of 2 Corinthians. Beginnings have their own mixture of anticipation and intimidation, don't they? In this case, we know that there will be many good things for us from God as we consider these 13 chapters, but it is always somewhat hard to get started with a new project. I've not always done introductions to the books that I have preached through. Sometimes I want to jump right in. I don't necessarily feel that there will be great value in an introduction. But I think that this time taken tonight is well spent. This will prepare us for what is coming and right from the start of the letter. But I will admit, it's not easy to decide what to include in one message regarding a long letter such as this. It's one thing to say, yeah, we ought to have an introduction. And then it's another when you sit down at the desk and you look at the whole letter and you say, okay, one message. I'm going to kind of bring all of that to you. You might be wondering why I chose this book at this time. It seemed right to be in the New Testament on Sunday evenings. The plan on Wednesday nights is to stay in the Old Testament after whatever we end up doing with Exodus. We're halfway through. As I told you, we're not going to do every verse of the rest of it as we've done with the first part. We'll see how that goes. I am thinking that the book of Ezra will be up next after Exodus. Okay, you don't hear too much about Ezra in the church. but that's where we're going. But we've still got some good time in Exodus. And then I want to revisit the book of Judges after we have finished with the Gospel of John. And we've still got a fair amount to go in John as well, but we have not been in that historical account for 10 years at least, by my reckoning. So by the time we're out of John, I think that's where we're going to go on Sunday mornings. So once the decision was made to tackle something in the New Testament in the evening, it wasn't too hard to narrow the choices down. We're already in a gospel, the Gospel of John, and I've preached through everything in those books anyway, except for a very few places in Matthew. But I've been really everywhere in the Gospels, so we wouldn't do that clearly. There are only three other books that I have not preached all the way through in the time that I've been here. Isn't that interesting? Of the whole New Testament that I've preached, okay, I've taught in these books, but I haven't preached all the way through, and there are just three of them, Colossians, Hebrews, and 2 Corinthians. Now, Colossians, I taught through at the time I took over the older adult Sunday school class. So that wasn't terribly long ago, but I did teach through that book verse by verse in that forum. And it is too much like John anyway. What's the theme of Colossians? It's the deity of Christ and all that he is, and that's what we're getting week by week in John. And then I remembered, was again informed, that Allison is looking at Colossians for the... No, Colossians came up... It was for the ladies' fellowship. That's what I was thinking, the ladies' fellowship. I found out that Colossians was what you ladies were going to be going through, so that kind of confirmed that idea. And then Hebrews, I recently preached all through chapter 11. Do you remember? The Hall of Faith. Going through that verse by verse. And we've been through other chapters in Hebrews in other studies, such as going through chapter 7 and all the stuff about Melchizedek when we were going through our study of Genesis. So we have spent some time there. We were there talking about the New Covenant in our recent Kingdom series as well. So, 2 Corinthians impressed me as the clear winner as far as what to pursue on Sunday nights. It contains the most untouched material of any New Testament book that I have not preached. And it's certainly a book with much practical instruction for the church. I was just reading something by MacArthur, and then also I was talking with Charlie, and he had had something about this from something that he had read, that 2 Corinthians is one of the least preached New Testament books in the church. And the reason for that is, if you're going to do one of the Corinthian letters, logically you're going to preach 1 Corinthians, aren't you? You wouldn't tend to start by preaching 2 Corinthians if you've never done 1 Corinthians. But by the time you've preached through 1 Corinthians, you're feeling that you don't really want to get into 2 Corinthians right away. And so you think, well, I'll do that, you know, some other time. You've already been through 16 chapters with the Corinthians. You're ready to go to something else. And you don't get back to it in today's short pastorates and so forth. You just don't tend to get into 2 Corinthians in a preaching series. But I hope that you will find it engaging, because we will be in this book for more than a year. So we really want to give it every opportunity to have its effect on us. Well, that's the introduction to the introduction. I've divided our outline into three C's: Corinth, chronology, and content. We will deal with the first of these rather quickly, but it seemed right to make a few comments about the city in which this church sought to follow the Lord. Corinth was located at a highly strategic site in the middle of the country that we know of as Greece today. There is an isthmus, very difficult word to say, and I'll have to say it several times tonight. I-S-T-H-M-U-S, isthmus. That is a bridge of land, and in this case it connects northern Greece with the large southern peninsula of Greece known as the Peloponnese. Corinth sat on the southwestern end of this isthmus, this little bridge of land that connected the country. Well, just think about that. You know, if your location is at the end of the land bridge that connects the two parts of your country, you're going to be important to, for instance, trade. Think about it. All of the land trade that came from the northern end of the country into the southern end of the country had to go through this area. Movement, period, from one end of the country. There's just people who had to travel from one reason to another. They passed through the city. You're going to have a lot of inns going on there. It also connected the Aegean and Mediterranean seas on its eastern side to the Ionian and Adriatic seas on the other. Big bodies of water, important bodies of water on each side of the city. So needless to say, this place had the potential to be a huge commercial center, and it was in Paul's day. This had not been true in the recent past, however. Corinth had rebelled against Rome 200 years earlier than Paul's time and had been burned to the ground as a consequence. At one point, there was nothing there. Its citizens were all sold off as slaves. And the city was not revived until 46 BC by Julius Caesar. It was completely restocked with Romans and those loyal to Rome. By the time of Caesar Augustus, okay, we're at the time of Christ's birth, Corinth had prospered sufficiently to be named the capital of the new province of Achaia. From that point, it was boom times for this city at the crossroads of Europe. Romans, Greeks, and Jews flocked to Corinth to take part in the prophets that beckoned. By Paul's day, this was the second leading city in Greece. It was wealthy and cosmopolitan, rivaling but not surpassing Athens as a center of culture. The great orators and thinkers of the day were heard often in its forums. This was also a deeply dark and immoral place. Corinth was a world leader in idolatrous worship, as you might expect, such a bustling center of the kind of the known civilized world. Its temple to Aphrodite dominated the heights on this isthmus. Very famous temple. The immorality associated with the worship of Aphrodite made Corinth notorious. Okay? A lady of the evening was known throughout the Greco-Roman world as a Corinthian girl. That tells you a little bit about this city. There was also a shrine to Asclepius, where healings were said to take place continually. There's definite value in knowing these facts about this city because they relate to the sins and the challenges that Paul faced in dealing with those who were converted in this context. You know, those who became part of the Corinthian church out of this kind of a culture. There were both Jews and Gentiles of various backgrounds in this body. This was a church that was prone to intellectual pride. Okay? They were used to the great thinkers and philosophers and so forth, hearing them debating the ideas of the age and so forth. Intellectual pride, big here. Immorality, of course, they were used to that, especially in the corruption of worship. They associated the worship of the divine with immoral acts. And so they had to learn very differently. Also, we know in Corinth, in the Corinthian church, there was a problem with the stumbling of those who had been in idolatry. The eating of things that had been sacrificed to idols and so forth. So all of this was a problem in the church because of the pressure of this culture. Much of this we do know from 1 Corinthians, and this book will pick right up from that letter in many of its concerns. Well, that's some of the background on Corinth. The mention of 1 Corinthians reminds us that Paul had a history with this church. As we come to 2 Corinthians, there's a history here that predates this letter. So let's turn to the matter of chronology to trace this from the beginning. What was Paul's relationship with this group of people? There are perhaps more complicated timeline issues with this book than with any other of Paul's writings. It will be helpful to you if you do pay attention here, maybe take some good notes, because I will be referring to these events often as we go through 2 Corinthians. Okay? And as I said, it starts from early on. Paul first came to this city on his second missionary journey. He stayed in Corinth for 18 months. Okay, if you think of Paul's moving around, 18 months, that was substantial. Surpassed only by Ephesus, which we'll talk about on the third missionary journey. Okay? 18 months with the Corinthians. That spanned the years 50 to 52 AD. Acts 18, 1 through 17. You might want to jot that down because we're not going to go there. But Acts 18, 1 through 17 gives us a brief account of these months. very brief considering the time span. You might want to look that up later, refresh yourself on this aspect of the relationship. But just to give you a quick summary of that, we find in that passage that both Jews and Gentiles responded to the gospel, good response to the gospel, in a climate of much Jewish opposition. The Jews tried to, you know, put a stop to this, as they almost always did, but were unable to do so. At one point, Paul is brought before the proconsul of Achaia, the Roman official that ruled on legal disputes and so forth in this province. Paul was brought to the proconsul by the Jews, but the Roman official would hear nothing of their dispute with the apostle. He saw that as nothing that he needed to weigh in on. And in fact, the leader of the synagogue in Corinth is actually the one who ends up being beaten before the judgment seat. You know, they haul in Paul and think they've got this case and something's going to happen to them, and God works through that official and turns everything around, and at the end they're beaten on the Jewish leader. So he perhaps learned a little lesson there. God had told Paul at the beginning of his ministry there not to worry about persecution in the city while he was there during this time. And God definitely protected him during this time while he was making disciples. Paul had to feel rather good about the church that had taken shape in Corinth when he left it after those 18 months to return to his sending church in Antioch. It was time to go back, give a report, refresh himself, with the fellowship there, perhaps replenish the funds, whatever it might be. So he did go back to Antioch. But by the time that Paul was traveling on his third missionary journey, this was a year or so later, he was getting word of serious problems developing in the church at Corinth. Sometime in the year 54, while Paul was ministering in Ephesus during that two-year residence there that I mentioned, he sent a letter to the Corinthian church about what was going on. Paul refers to this letter in 1 Corinthians 5, 9 through 11. You can turn to that with me. 1 Corinthians 5, 9 through 11. Paul states here, "I wrote you in my letter not to associate with immoral people. I did not at all mean with the immoral people of this world, or with the covetous and swindlers, or with idolaters, for then you would have to go out of the world. But actually, I wrote to you not to associate with any so-called brother, if he is an immoral person, or covetous, or an idolater, or a reviler, or a drunkard, or a swindler, not even to eat with such a one." Well, isn't this interesting? "But actually, I wrote to you." Okay, which letter are we reading from here? This is 1 Corinthians, right? But Paul's talking about a previous letter that he had written to them. Do we have this epistle? No. No, we don't have that particular letter. It was obviously not something that was needed by the larger church. It was not an inspired writing. But it is clear that the situation in chapter 5 that is talked about, this person acting immorally, and if you know or remember about this, you know, at the start of chapter 5, talking about this man who has his father's wife in the church, and they're not doing anything about it. In fact, they're kind of acting like it's cool to tolerate this kind of thing. So that had been going along, and Paul had written to them previously about that situation. There had been questions about what to do with sinners Paul had told the members in this previous letter to not associate with such people. Don't associate with them. But there had been confusion over Paul's meaning. Some were saying that there should be no relationship with any kind of a sinner, including those who were outside the church. Just the unbelievers who had nothing to do with the church. They were saying, well, we're not supposed to associate with them. That's what Paul said in his letter. So because of that confusion and obviously many other matters, the apostle was led to write 1 Corinthians in 55 A.D. Paul is now clarifying his teaching about associating with sinners. It was only those who were members of the church and yet were continuing in blatant disobedience who were to be cut off from fellowship. He's clarifying that for him. No, it's people who are in your church and saying that they're believers and saying that they're brothers and sisters, and then they just continue on in sin no matter, you know, what is said. Those are the people that you disfellowship. I'm not talking about, you know, evangelism opportunities here. Paul heard about all of the other questions and problems in this church from various sources. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, we read about Chloe's people who informed Paul about the factions and the quarrels that were going on. And we know that this was a church, I'm of Paul, I'm of Peter, I'm of Apollos, I'm of Christ. There was a big problem of disunity in this church, and he'd heard all about that. Then in chapter 7, Paul mentions in verse 1 that the church had written to him with questions about numerous areas of church practice. He says, now concerning the things about which you wrote. And then he just goes through one topic after another. They had had questions. We're kind of floundering here, Paul. What do we do in this area? And he gave them his inspired instructions. Perhaps this letter was sent to Paul with Chloe's people, this letter from the Corinthian people with the questions that came with Chloe's people, who then told him about the factions and so forth. And then there is Paul's rejoicing at the end of 1 Corinthians about the coming of Stephanas and Fortunatus and Achaicus. He says these three people had come to him from the Corinthian church, and they undoubtedly added their observations about all the controversies going on. So even though Paul was in Ephesus, some distance away from Corinth, Paul was well informed and very concerned about this wayward church. He writes this long letter of 1 Corinthians about what should be done in matters of church leadership, church discipline, the worship of the church. He gives counsel about legal disputes and marriage and the use of Christian liberty. He also speaks of his intention to come soon and to help them implement the instructions. He would be coming at some point, hopefully relatively soon, to kind of seal in some of this instruction he was giving. But alas, there was not a good response to 1 Corinthians. It appears that there were those who were turning the church against the apostle. There was a refusal to submit to the apostolic direction of 1 Corinthians, a continuing toleration of sin among those who were styling themselves as leaders, movers and shakers in this church. It might be that Paul got word of this defiance through Timothy, who Paul intends to send to the church in 1 Corinthians. He talks about sending Timothy. Very, very likely he did, and he found out You know, maybe even 1 Corinthians was sent with him, and he found out, oh, the response is not good. In any case, Paul feels that he must try to right the ship in Corinth as soon as possible. And he visits Corinth earlier than he had planned. When he hears how badly things are going, he decides, I've just got to drop what's going on here and get over there. Well, this earlier than planned visit is what is known as the painful visit in the chronology of Paul's relationship with Corinth. And it was apparently very brief. We read of this in 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 1. Paul writes there, "But I determined this for my own sake, that I would not come to you in sorrow again." I would not come to you in sorrow again. For Paul to come in sorrow again, he would have had to come in sorrow a first time. Okay? And we don't have a record of that. And so this is what we call the painful visit. We add to this supposition, if you want to call it that, the content of verses 3 and 4 of chapter 2. Paul writes, "This is the very thing I wrote you, so that when I came, I would not have sorrow from those who ought to make me rejoice, having confidence in you all, that my joy would be the joy of you all. For out of much affliction and anguish of heart I wrote to you with many tears, not so that you would be made sorrowful, but that you might know the love which I have especially for you." So he talks about writing a letter here out of much affliction and anguish of heart, with many tears. This is what is known as the sorrowful letter. And it does not appear to be 1 Corinthians. This appears to be a letter in between 1 and 2 Corinthians. It was written after the painful visit. 1 Corinthians, yeah, it does deal with a lot of problems in the church, but the tone of 1 Corinthians is really rather matter of fact. We do not get the picture of Paul writing in with tears and anguish as he writes 1 Corinthians. It is more likely that Paul visited Corinth after 1 Corinthians, but had to quickly retreat in the face of much opposition to his authority. Paul was essentially humiliated in Corinth, probably at the hands of the man that he had told the church to discipline in 1 Corinthians 5. And we'll be picking up on this as we go along through 2 Corinthians. But probably this man was a powerful man, and he organized opposition that was already there, ready and waiting, against Paul, so that when he made his painful visit, he had to, you know, leave in shame, essentially, write a sorrowful letter. In other words, Paul's own disciples had turned against him in Corinth. And that is a scenario that has played out many times since. A pastor might start a church, people come to the Lord through him, he disciples them, and at some point they, you know, rebel against him and tell him to get lost. And that seems to be the scenario that took place with Paul in Corinth. Paul wrote this sorrowful letter, one of rebuke of the Corinthians for their behavior. What else could he do but write to them and say, this is just totally out of line. This man is totally out of line. He appears to demand once again the discipline of this person who was causing so much trouble for him. And that sorrowful letter, again, one that we do not have today, was seemingly sent with Titus. Paul then waited with great concern in Macedonia. He'd moved on from Ephesus to Macedonia. He waited there for the response to what was now his third letter to Corinth. Okay, again, don't have the first one. Second one is 1 Corinthians. Don't have the third one. Now we're coming to actually the fourth letter that he wrote to them. 2 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians is the letter that Paul wrote from Macedonia after he had heard back from Titus. Sent the sorrowful letter with Titus. Titus took it, oversaw what took place then in response to it, then came back to tell Paul what had happened. And the news was generally encouraging. The news of Titus was encouraging. There were still those around in the church in Corinth who were causing trouble. But the main issue that was involving the man who had opposed Paul, that had been resolved. The church was much more well disposed toward Paul than they had been during his painful visit. We find that the relationship was healed enough for Paul to then come through Corinth on his way from Macedonia to Jerusalem with the gift that he had been collecting for some time, the financial gift for the poor believers in Jerusalem. He was there long enough to write the letter to the Romans. I mean, you think about the letter to the Romans. You know, goodly letter. A lot of careful thinking going on in that. Certainly not a letter that you would think would be written in the midst of upset. So, relations were obviously much improved between Paul and Corinth at that point. It would be wonderful to be able to report that this church was then harmonious for many years to come. But the one testimony that we have on this matter, it's from Clement, early church father and writer and leader, Clement in 95 AD, not that much on past the time of Paul. His report is that the church was still struggling along in disharmony. Sad to hear. Well, we need to say something about the content of 2 Corinthians before we close. And as you might expect, that would be tied to the issues that we've already mentioned. Everyone seems to agree that we have three main sections of this letter. Chapters 1 through 7, chapters 8 and 9, and chapters 10 through 13. Chapters 1 through 7 are taken up with Paul's defense of his character and ministry. A defense of his character and ministry. He is clearly reacting to the negative thoughts about his motives and his actions and his words that were lingering on in Corinth. Yes, the man who had been the focus of opposition to Paul was repentant at this point. And there is joy and there is relief over this. Paul knows that the majority of the people in the church are now with him, and you will get that sense as we go through these early chapters. But there are still those in the church who were willing to cause problems. And chapters 10 through 13 will make that clear. The false apostles that we will meet at the end of this letter are in the background of these first chapters. Paul knows that these people are still lurking, ready to try and, you know, gin up again some opposition to Paul's teachings. But in these first chapters, Paul wants to explain himself to everyone there at Corinth. Here we will learn a lot about Paul's heart for ministry. Just a lot about his desire to have a right relationship with these people. There's a very intimate and vulnerable tone to these chapters. So I think you'll see that they're very different from a lot of Paul's writings, as this whole book is. But you'll have the sense that we're really looking, you know, deeply into Paul's heart and soul, what motivates him and what he wants other people to know about him. Chapters 8 and 9 involve the collection for the needy saints in Jerusalem. Famous chapters in regard to financial giving. This had been mentioned in 1 Corinthians. He'd talked to them about the gift. He talked to them about setting aside on the first day of the week, you know, something for this, right at the end of 1 Corinthians. But it seems that the importance of this ministry had been downplayed in the midst of the other issues, the many other issues. And you can kind of understand that. There were so many problems in this church that you could see this ministry kind of getting lost in it. Often you find in churches that are in crisis and having splits and so forth, financial giving is often diminished, isn't it, in times of disharmony, because people start kind of, you know, voting with their pocketbook, so to speak, you know, in the church. You know, they don't like that decision by the church leadership, so, you know, they're going to start designating their giving, and all of their giving now is going to go to the missionary, you know, in Outer Mongolia. And it's not going to be going to the general, you know, treasury of the church, because they don't agree with what's going on and so forth. So you start to run into a lot of that kind of stuff. Now Paul wants to get this effort back on the front burner, since he is going to be coming through Corinth shortly to receive what they had put aside. So he'll be talking about that in chapters 8 and 9 and bragging on the churches in Macedonia, and saying, hey, you guys need to step it up and have something ready for me when I come through, so that, you know, there'll be something pleasing to the Lord for me to take on to Jerusalem. And then in chapters 10 through 13, we have Paul defending his authority as an apostle, his authority. Early chapters more explaining himself and showing his motivations. As he gets to the end, His authority comes through strongly, and especially warning these leaders who were still causing problems for him of what will happen when he returns to Corinth. He's going to deal with them. Now, some commentators see chapters 10 through 13 as a separate letter, I guess you'd call it even a fifth letter, that became joined at some point to 2 Corinthians. Why do they say that? It's because the opposition that Paul is talking about at the end of the letter seems different from what Paul is speaking of in the earlier part of the letter. But most commentators rightly view this as simply a different challenge to Paul's authority. He started by dealing with the situation that had been resolved and, you know, talking about the issue surrounding that, but then at the end wants to make things clear to this different group. Here we have a number of Jewish teachers who styled themselves as apostles. Paul will even mockingly call them the super apostles. Okay, but they had come in. We see this so often, don't we? Paul begins a church, disciples, you know, forms it, but he has to leave at some point. And then what happens? You know, in come the infiltrators to take what Paul has started and lead it in another direction for their own purposes. And it seems clearly that happened in Corinth. They'd come in after Paul had left. They had wowed the Corinthians with their oratorical skills and their claims to power. They were very much in contrast with Paul's demeanor and his way of going about things. They were more in line with the culture, the make a big splash, make big claims, appear very learned and superior and so forth. Some see these false apostles as also having a Judaizing influence. But if that is so, that is not at all prominent in this letter. And I don't really see that personally. But just so you know, some see also the legalistic kind of aspect that these people would be bringing in. I see them mostly as having this very, what you'd call a triumphalist posture, such as what we saw in 1 Corinthians chapter 4 in our Kingdom series, when we're talking about, these people who were acting as if they were already in the kingdom, and Paul was saying, I wish that you had really got as far as you think that you have, because then we'd all be reigning. But he said, that's not really the way it is. Okay, well, he really zeroes in on them at the end of 2 Corinthians. They thought they had arrived spiritually. And they were only too happy to let others know about how they had arrived. And they were lording it over the other people. And Paul is just aghast that the Corinthians would allow themselves to be abused by such people. I'll mention one other way to outline these three sections that I read in a commentary by Philip Hughes. He sees these sections in terms of Paul's intention to come to Corinth. Chapters 1 through 7 is his explanation of the lack of a visit, okay? And that's obviously a bone of contention that he works through early on in this letter, that he hadn't shown up when they thought that he was going to come, and they're wondering why. Chapters 1 and 2 make it clear that Paul had delayed coming to Corinth again until the air had cleared. That's why he hadn't come. He wanted to come when things could be, in a certain situation. Then chapters 8 and 9, in this kind of an outline, are the preparation for the visit, which involves the collection, get the money prepared and everything for when I do get there. And then the last chapters speak of the certainty of the visit and what it would involve, mainly in that idea of warning those who were still in opposition of what this visit would mean. So, As we wrap this up, what will we see in this book over the next year and more? As I said, this is considered the most in-depth look into the personality of Paul. If you really want to look at something and say, what made this guy tick? What kept him going? Well, this is the letter for you. We see here his sincerity. He's very open about his struggles. We see his hopes. We see his fears. He opens his heart in this letter to those who had hurt him again and again. This is about a pastor who is patient and forgiving with those in a flock that just never seemed to give him the benefit of the doubt. And yet he extends that openness to them, remaining open to them, remaining vulnerable, while still upholding the truth. And that can be a balancing act that needs a lot of grace. As we go along, we get teaching on church discipline, subject that has fallen somewhat into disarray in the church. We will talk about new covenant ministry. What is that? We dealt with that in the Kingdom series a bit, but now we'll get into detail. We'll talk about suffering and future glory. There is suffering for the believer. But what does Paul hold out beyond that? We'll talk about sacrificial giving and its rewards. That's in that middle part, 8 and 9. A lot about that. Certainly if money issues are, an area of difficulty for you, perhaps disobedience, that would not, be an area that would go without conviction as we went through it. Not that I anticipate that anybody does, considering the support that we have in this church. We'll also read about submission to the Lord and his designated authorities, as Paul does weigh in on his own authority. This is a letter that rebukes rebellion in the church strongly. It's showing us how we are to live in unity as Christ's church. So this therefore continues to be a very timely word, I believe. I think these are all just very helpful matters for us to consider today. This is an encouragement for pastors to hang in there, even when ministry is tough. I mean, it's just amazing how Paul kept going. And this was just one of the churches that he was dealing with. And yet he persevered with them. We all need to rely on God's comfort. That's where we'll start up next week. God's grace when we face obstacles in God's service. Because we are going to face those. It is going to come. It's going to be hard at times. So this is a very realistic book, and we'll get right into that. It's an encouragement to all the members of the body to beware of challenging the authority of the apostles and what they have laid down in God's Word. You know, they've told us the way things are to be in the church. God will vindicate those who submit to His instructions and therefore minister with a clear conscience. And He will severely discipline those who do not. Let's pray. Father, we thank You for a wonderful day. Just a wonderful time of celebration. So many good things that we've enjoyed. And here, You've given us a lot more to think about and to anticipate and be excited about. We pray that You would use this letter greatly in our lives as its truths, its principles, its instructions unfold to us over these next months. May we remember this as a precious time in this part of Your Word because of the good changes that it brought about in our lives. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.